Summer 1942. In the dead of night, 8 well-armed and equipped Nazi saboteurs are landed from submarines on Long Island and the Florida coast. Dispatched by Hitler himself, the invaders' mission was simple: sabotage industrial targets and spread terror throughout our country. I'm Oliver North, and in this War Stories podcast, you're going to hear from eyewitness participants about how the U.S. Coast Guard and the FBI foiled a Nazi dictator's sinister plans. You'll learn from those who were there how the plotters were discovered, tracked down, and brought to swift justice. It's a tale worthy of a Hollywood thriller, but this one's all true. Given all the hand-wringing we've heard about military tribunals for terrorists detained at Gitmo, you may be stunned at the outcome. And if you think the idea of radicalizing people living here, even American citizens, began with Islamist jihadis, listen carefully to the riveting account of how the FBI hunted and apprehended an entire cell of Nazi agents in New York City. All 44 of these spies and saboteurs spoke English, worked in American factories and businesses, and like many of the terrorists among us today, their friends, neighbors, and co-workers had no idea they were dealing with sworn enemies. By the end of this War Stories podcast, you may wonder, as I do, why we no longer deal with evil, vicious enemies as we did during World War II.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter's been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/war. That's ZipRecruiter.com/war. One more time. Try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/war.
Good evening. I'm Oliver North on the shores of Long Island. Welcome to War Stories. Adolf Hitler once said, "Demoralize the enemy from within by surprise, terror, sabotage, and assassination. This is the war of the future." He was right, for no one will ever forget those tactics being used more than half a century later on that fateful day in September 2001. But what you may not know is that America was actually invaded on a foggy night in the summer of 1942. A group of Nazi saboteurs landed here, right here on this beach in eastern Long Island. Their mission? To strike at the heart of America with acts of sabotage. And just like the terrorists from 9/11, they had all lived in America, and they all knew our country well. This is the story of the men who invaded our country and those who stopped them.
The Germans had threatened the United States long before 1942. In 1916, while World War I was raging in Europe, Americans felt safe. Imperial Germany was waging an all-out war against Britain and France, but the fighting was taking place more than 3,000 miles away across the Atlantic Ocean. Americans were more concerned about baseball. Although President Woodrow Wilson had officially declared the United States neutral in the conflict, we were supplying the British and French with munitions, and the Germans knew it. Using a Manhattan brownstone as a headquarters, several German spies organized an attack against America. At 2:08 a.m. on July 29, 1916, an enormous explosion occurred near the Statue of Liberty at a place then called Black Tom Island.
Black Tom was an ammunition depot off the coast of New Jersey in New York Harbor, and it had an extraordinary amount of explosives.
Richard Powers is a history professor at City University of New York, and the author of Secrecy and Power, The Life of J. Edgar Hoover.
This was detonated with one of the most remarkable explosions in New York City until the World Trade Center bombings, shattering windows in New Jersey, Manhattan, over in Brooklyn.
The dark cloud of sabotage rose above the United States. Though still neutral, America was becoming painfully aware of the enemy within. And everywhere the words Black Tom were on an angry nation's lips.
The investigation afterwards pointed to German sabotage.
The sabotage had been ordered by this man, German intelligence officer Franz von Papen, to stop U.S. arms shipments to Europe. Barely 12 months after Black Tom Island was attacked, the United States declared war on Germany. Then, like now, homeland security became imperative, and one government agency stepped up to the plate, the FBI.
The G-Men. This is a Bureau of Scientific Crime Detection. New, modern, up to the minute. The FBI never sleeps. The G-Men have become a legend. So what's the mystery behind their badge?
The predecessor to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or the FBI, was the Bureau of Investigation. The name wasn't officially changed to the FBI until 1935.
The Bureau of Investigation started with approximately 33 special agents. It went through a number of periods of rapid growth, first and foremost during World War I.
One young clerk working for the Department of Justice, monitoring German Americans at this time, was a man named J. Edgar Hoover. And by age 29, he'd been named the Bureau Director. As seen here in this FBI film, Hoover took an active role both in his agent's training and in shaping his personal public image. At first, Hoover targeted gangsters. He used fingerprinting and new technologies to crack down on organized crime.
You had a series of highly publicized gang-busting campaigns by the FBI, and the names are very familiar. This is Machine Gun Kelly, Pretty Boy Floyd, and, of course, John Dillinger.
When Machine Gun Kelly was captured, he begged, "G-men, don't shoot," meaning government men, and the name G-men flashed in the news.
During the mid-30s, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI became national heroes, and before they knew it, they really had turned the Bureau of Investigation into public heroes, and Hoover himself was even called public hero number one by some publicists.
But while Hoover was wiping the floor with gangsters, a storm was once again brewing across the ocean. Barely 14 years after the end of World War I, Germany was again on the rise. By 1933, Hitler was chancellor and established the Third Reich and began his master plan for world domination and racial purity. Although the United States was an ocean away, it didn't escape Hitler's plan.
The Nazis had a very dangerous idea. The idea was anyone of German extraction anywhere in the world, they were to be officially represented by Nazi Germany. Hitler would speak for them.
Ernest Volkmann is the author of Espionage, the Greatest Spy Operations of the 20th Century.
Now, they took a look over the United States and said, there's about 30 million Americans of German descent over there. What an incredible pool.
Some American organizations fell in goose step with the German dictator. One organization took the lead role, the German-American Bund, or League, as seen here in these shocking propaganda films made right here in America.
The German-American Bund was mostly made up of immigrants from Germany after World War I.
Marvin Miller studied the German-American Bund extensively and is the author of Wunderlich's Salute.
Hitler to them was a godsend. They couldn't glory in him more than their favorite movie star.
The people who ran the Bund believed in the chief Nazi propaganda of the so-called New World Order. It would be a fascistic, pro-Nazi world order.
The head of the German-American Bund was this man, Fritz Kuhn. Kuhn was a self-styled Führer of the United States. He came to America in 1927 and lived in New York and Detroit. Kuhn created a network of approximately a dozen camps throughout the U.S., attracting thousands of enthusiastic followers.
The Bund had several so-called training camps, summer camps, most notoriously Camp Hindenburg, and there was Camp Siegfried.
You're watching movies shot at Bund training camps in northern New Jersey, Riverdale in the Bronx, and out on Long Island. Their mission? To train Americans to become Nazis.
They would get the children. The children would be enrolled in the Bund's version of the Hitler Youth. And they would have uniforms, and they would march around and sit around the campfire and listened to German propaganda.
He had a place for the girls. He wanted them to be strong, and they do various exercises to build up their bodies. Build up their bodies for what purpose? To be strong mothers, to give birth to the future Wehrmacht, the war machine.
Would support Nazi policies and serve as a potential fifth column, possibly, down the road. And more importantly, a recruiting pool from which they could draw intelligence assets.
One man especially valuable to Hitler was Walter Cappy. Cappy worked at a factory making farm tools before he became a journalist in Chicago at a German-American newspaper. In 1935, he applied to become a U.S. citizen, but he was denied.
Cap became the press chief for the German-American Bund.
By the late 1930s, their success began to worry some Americans. J. Edgar Hoover was only too happy to investigate.
President Roosevelt asked Hoover to conduct an investigation to let them know what the scope of their activities were and how dangerous this was. Before long, they had a pretty good sense of everyone who was involved in the German-American Bund and the Nazi underground in this country.
Coming up next, how many Nazi sympathizers were living here in the United States in 1939? More than enough to fill Madison Square Garden to the rafters. And find out how 33 members of a Nazi spy ring conducted covert operations right here in America. That's next on War Stories.
February 20th, 1939, you're looking at 22,000 German-American Bund members at Madison Square Garden in New York City for a fundraising rally. Throughout the night, tension mounted in the garden. Then all hell broke loose when Bund leader Fritz Kuhn spoke to the crowd.
My very great privilege to welcome you to another mass demonstration sponsored by the German-American Bund.
The young Jewish man stormed the stage.
This youngster, Isidor Greenbaum, ran up towards the stage and was intercepted by the Ordnungsdienst, the strongman group of the German-American Bund, and he was beaten. This made headline news.
6 months after the rally in New York, the Nazi blitzkrieg invaded Poland. World War II had begun. Immediately, American public opinion turned against Nazi Germany and its sympathizers, and groups like the German-American Bund and its network of camps were closed. Although the U.S. wouldn't enter the war for another 2 years, Hoover was on high alert for espionage operations that could damage U.S. war production efforts already underway.
We had to face and focus on the fact that there was a worldwide network building with the long-range concept of taking over our country.
Kenneth Crosby grew up on a farm in West Point, Mississippi, where he helped his father grow cotton and raise cattle. After graduating from college, he went on to earn a law degree from the University of Mississippi. And in 1939, Crosby became FBI agent number 831.
What kind of training did you get for dealing with things like counterespionage?
We had routine investigative procedures. We had surveillance procedures. We spent 2 full weeks down at your Marine base firing range.
Agent Crosby was quickly assigned to infiltrate and help capture 33 German men and women who were operating inside New York City as enemy agents. All spoke English and moved about the city unnoticed. Their mission? Stealing U.S. secrets.
They stole the blueprint of the Norden bomb site, which before the atom bomb was the most important secret we had. They stole the prints and got them to Germany.
This man, Frederick Fritz Duquesne, was sent by the Abwehr, the German Foreign Intelligence Service, to run the spy network. It was called the Duquesne Spy Ring.
Hitler's clearly anticipating, the Abwehr is anticipating the United States is going to get in the war. Oh. That's why he's here.
We were in the middle of a buildup 2 years before Pearl Harbor, and they wanted the information of what was going on, war materials, weaponry.
The problem was, how do you get all this information back to Germany? Well, you can't send Fritz back and forth. They would find a master spy. He would collect all their information, he would encode it, and then he would send it via a special radio back to Germany.
Enter William Sebold, a.k.a. FBI double agent Harry Sawyer.
The man walking up and down the street is Harry Sawyer, a naturalized German-American citizen. Sawyer visited Germany in 1939, where he was approached by the Gestapo, who urged him to return to the United States as a spy. Before leaving Germany, he sent word to us. A spy trap was set. Sawyer was working for the FBI.
Next, the FBI got Sebold an office in Times Square where he could meet with enemy agents. Ken Crosby was one of the FBI agents who helped shoot these undercover films.
We set up his office. We set it up with a double mirror where we could photograph through the mirror everything that went on in the Sebold office.
And every time somebody came into Sebold's office and handed over a blueprint, somebody was running a movie camera.
The first time that I covered that particular role of the camera, I'll never forget. Fritz Duquesne, Fritz walks into the office to give his report to Sebold. Very suspicious, very good. He stops and he looks all around the room very carefully. And he looks right at that mirror. I think he's looking right at me. I thought, uh-oh, something's gone wrong. I haven't worked this thing right. If he sees me, the whole thing's blown. I've blown the whole case, and I'm ready to collapse. He pulls out his pocket comb, and he starts combing his hair.
On June 29, 1941, the FBI simultaneously arrested all 33 German spies. The trial was held in Federal District Court in Brooklyn.
Toward the end of the trial, the prosecution brings Sebold in. They say that that was the most memorable, shocking incident to these 33 subjects when they realized how they had been duped by this double agent.
All 33 spies were found guilty on December 13, 1941, and sentenced to almost 300 years in prison. By 1954, they'd all been paroled. Duquesne died of a stroke in 1956.
What happens to Sebold afterwards?
We did not have a formal witness protection program at that time, which we have today. But in effect, the Bureau settled him on a farm in California.
Agent Crosby would be sent to Latin America. We'd help the FBI arrest hundreds of Nazi spies. The FBI successfully brought down the Duquesne spy ring, but more were on the way.
Hitler ordered sabotage operations against key targets in the United States. Find out how 8 Nazi saboteurs slipped into the country right here on a mission to wreak havoc. That's next on War Stories.
December 7, 1941, America was surprised when Japan, not Germany, struck first. And in response, as we entered the war, boys enlisted, troops shipped out, and war manufacturing shifted into high gear. And out at sea, U.S. ships faced an ever-present German U-boat threat. Germans called it happy time when they sank hundreds of U.S. and British ships off our East Coast.
The losses in the first months of the war were enormous. Ships are being sunk, sometimes within sight of the city. And they began to black out cities at night. And that brought the losses to a very dramatic decline.
Bright lights of New York, as they will not be seen again till after this war. No more bright signs flicker on Times Square. The East Coast is dimmed out because Nazi U-boats can sink ships by silhouetting them against the glow of the shore. A blackout, and off go the lights.
Just months after Pearl Harbor, the Nazis came up with a terror plot of their own. It was called Operation Pastorius, named after Francis Daniel Pastorius, one of the first German immigrants to come to America.
The main German intelligence agency, known as the Abwehr, was given the assignment by Hitler, do something about this huge American production facility, which is about to bury us under weapons. There's no way in the world we can outproduce the United States. that American production capacity is going to have to be crippled in some way.
A team of saboteurs are given multiple targets to blow up, including aluminum plants, railroads, and Jewish-owned department stores.
The Nazi saboteurs also had orders to try to spread panic and confusion by putting time-release bombs in movie theaters, in places where the public would assemble. And so from that point, I guess you'd say that these were terrorist operations as well, in which the purpose was to convince the public that they could not be protected by the government, and therefore the public was helpless.
Remember this man from the German-American Bund? The Abwehr chose 39-year-old Walter Kappe, former German-American Bund propaganda chief, to lead Operation Pistorius. He left the U.S. and moved back to Germany before the war. Kappe recruited 8 men who would undergo terrorist training at an Abwehr camp outside of Berlin.
Some of them were picked because they had been members of the Bund. 7 of the 8 saboteurs were members of the Bund. It's my understanding that 3 of them knew about Camp Siegfried and attended there.
They'd all lived here. They had, in 2 cases, become American citizens. They'd all returned to Germany because they wanted to work for the German war effort. A number of them were already in the German army. And then they underwent a re-immersion into American life by means of movies, magazines, and newspapers, so that they would know ball scores, they would know who the movie stars were, they would know public events.
These were the 8 saboteurs Kappe chose. George Dash, 39, Ernst Berger, 35, Heinrich Heinck, 35, Richard Kieran, 34, John Curling, 32, Werner Thiel, 31, Hermann Neubauer, 32, and at 22, the baby, Herbert Haupt. They all spoke flawless English, so they could blend in easily.
It was foggy here on this beach that night in June of 42, when German U-boat 202, right out there, delivered 4 Nazi saboteurs and a boatload of explosives. Their mission, the destruction of key installations vital to America's war effort, and to terrorize the American people. But one man stood between success and failure for this Nazi invasion. Find out what happened when the saboteurs met a 21-year-old Coast Guardsman. That's next on War Stories.
On May 26, 1942, the 8 Nazi saboteurs were poised to launch their attacks on America. Supplied with explosives and thousands of dollars in cash, the first team of saboteurs boarded a U-boat from Lorient, France, and headed for the Florida coast. 2 days later, the second team of saboteurs left, bound for the shores of Long Island. These were the men. The Long Island team was led by the eldest saboteur, 39-year-old George Dash. Dash served in the German Army in World War I, then immigrated to America as a stowaway. After serving a year in the Army Air Corps, he found work as a waiter. In 1939, he returned to Germany after World War II broke out. With Dash was 35-year-old Ernst Berger, a former Nazi stormtrooper and U.S. citizen. The others in that U-boat were Heinrich Heinck, 35, and Richard Kieran, 34, both machinists who met while working at a Volkswagen factory in Germany. The Florida team was run by 32-year-old John Curling. Curling was a standing member of the Nazi Party who moved to the U.S. in 1929 for work as a butler. Joining him was Hermann Neubauer, 31, and Werner Thiel, 35, both Nazi Party members. The last man on the team was Herbert Haupt, barely 22. He was the youngest saboteur and a U.S. citizen who grew up in Chicago.
On June 13, 1942, a German U-boat approached the south shore of Long Island off Amagansett and landed a team of 4 German saboteurs.
Ronald Meister is a former U.S. naval officer in the Judge Advocate General Corps.
They had been trained in the use of explosives to use in blowing up train stations, water treatment facilities, and factories in the United States.
Once they got to the beach, they took off their German uniforms, they buried all of their supplies, and then, of course, they would later go back, retrieve their supplies, and commence operations.
Their targets included bridges, railroads, and aluminum plants in Ohio, New York, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. But on that dark, foggy night, things went wrong right from the start.
Well, as I went down the beach, maybe 200 yards from the station, 300, I saw two men. I'd been walking this beach for a couple of months, and I had never seen anybody there.
John Cullen was only 21 years old when he was assigned to patrol the beach in Amagansett. A native New Yorker, he'd only been in the Coast Guard 6 months.
I called out to him. I said, "What are you doing?" So the one fella turned around and came toward me, came walking up, and that was Dash. And he said, "We're fishermen and our boat ran aground. We intend to stay here till daybreak." I says, "Daybreak? That's 4 or 5 hours. I says, "Why don't you come up to the station and have some coffee and stay there?" He says, "No, thanks, but we'll be all right here." He says, "Do you have a mother and father?" I said, "That's a strange thing to ask." I says, "Yes, I do." He says, "Would you like to see them again?" I said, "Yes, I would." Meantime, there was a fellow with a sea bag in back of me who had just come there, and he spoke in German. So when he spoke in German, I said, "Oh, this isn't good."
If they had followed their training, they should have killed him on the spot and buried him also on the beach. Instead, they decided they would try to talk him out of doing anything, and they offered him a bribe.
Dash said to me, "I'll give you some money if you forget about seeing us here." I said, "Well, I don't want the money, but I can forget." So he says, "Well, I'll give you what I thought was $300. It was $280. I only took the money to prove that I met somebody here, because I didn't think anybody had believed the story. So I didn't turn around. I backed up. And when I got out of his sight, I ran."
Cullen ran back to the Coast Guard station to tell his bosses what had happened. They called the FBI.
We went back to the boathouse, got a couple of shovels, and we came back and dug these cases we found in there. That sea bag that fellow had, that was in there. It was in German uniforms. In the cases were different types of incendiary bombs. So when he saw that, he says, "Boy, we got something big here." And the FBI came. They grilled me for 32 hours.
But they should have searched the local train station. After the encounter with Cullen, the saboteurs headed for the Long Island Railroad. And like good commuters, they took the first morning train to New York City. Meanwhile, in Washington, Hoover ordered the largest manhunt in the Bureau's history.
"The recent landing of saboteurs from Nazi submarines sounds a new alert for all Americans."
Except for Cullen's story and description of Dash as a man with a streak of gray hair, they had no leads. In New York, the saboteurs lived the high life. They stayed in hotels, shopped at Macy's, and ate in posh restaurants. But George Dash began having a change of heart.
The realization struck Dash, who did know a lot about the United States, about the puny size of their capabilities and the immense strength of the United States. A sense of futility probably came over him. He was a saboteur. He would be executed. Nothing that would make his sacrifice worthwhile in the broad scheme of the German war effort.
Dash convinced Ernest Berger to join him in betraying the mission.
He said his name was George Dash. He'd just come back from Germany. I was in charge of the sabotage unit, and had 4 agent supervisors underneath.
Dwayne Traynor joined the FBI in 1938. He grew up in Devil's Lake, North Dakota, and married his high school sweetheart, Evelyn. He earned a law degree and was paid the princely sum of $100 a month. But when he heard the FBI was paying $3,200 a year, Traynor joined the Bureau.
Had you had any sabotage cases?
Oh, there were literally hundreds of reported sabotage cases. Somebody would get mad at the supervisor and he would sabotage something and that kind of thing, but there was nothing serious.
Dash was well aware of the FBI.
I want you to tell Mr. Hoover I'm going down to Washington. I want to talk to him about sabotage. And I said, well, fine. I'll get someone to bring you over here. And I called the Washington field office, and a couple of agents picked him up and brought him over to my office. So they brought him over to my office, and they walked in, and the first thing I saw was a man with a white streak in his hair. And I thought, well, after all that briefing we've had, we've probably got something.
Did Dash tell you during your interview with him why he was turning himself in?
He'd gone back to Germany because he was all gung-ho about Hitler. And he became disenchanted, and he wanted to broadcast to the German people that they were being put upon by a terrible man.
Was he able to tell you about how he was trained back in Germany for his missions?
Oh, yeah. He described the school that they attended and how their training was and how they were exposed to making these bombs active.
How long did this interview last?
I interviewed him for 2 days, got him to finally tell how they landed and how they got into New York. And then I got him to identify who was in his group. Berger, Heinck, and Quirn. They were all to meet at General Grant's statue in New York City at 5 o'clock every day.
After Dash's confession, the FBI quickly rounded up the remaining two Long Island saboteurs. Kieran was arrested as he left a tailor shop, and Heinck as he left a drugstore. But then, Dash told Agent Traynor about the other four Nazis who'd landed in Florida.
I was the first person in the United States to understand we had a second group on hand. Those fellows landed, buried their stuff, went into Jacksonville, bought new clothes and everything.
What'd you do at that point?
I wanted to know who was in the group. And he identified Curling, he identified Nybauer, and he identified a young man by the name of Herbie Haup, one man by the name of Thiel.
Curling had written his contact information for Dash in invisible ink on this handkerchief. The only problem was, Dash couldn't remember how to develop the ink so he could read it.
I sent it up to the lab that first day, and then next morning when it came back, they had developed the writing on it in red colors. It developed with ammonia fumes, and so we now had the name of a contact for Curling in New York.
The secret handkerchief led to Curling's arrest in a New York bar where he was drinking and plotting with Thiel. Shortly thereafter, Haup and Neubauer were arrested in Chicago near Haup's parents' home. Hoover, ever the politician, didn't want anyone, including the president, to know how the saboteurs were caught.
The eight saboteurs are tried in a top-secret military tribunal. Find out what happened next, right here on War Stories.
It took just 2 weeks for the eight Nazi saboteurs to be arrested and charged with sabotage, espionage, and conspiracy to commit both. They'd hoped to be treated as prisoners of war, not spies.
The key thing was that if they had been intercepted before they landed, they would have been treated as prisoners of war. They then took off their uniforms, buried them, and went into their essentially American garb. And that, at that point, made them spies and saboteurs, and of course, subject to the death penalty by the Articles of War.
For these men, accused of attempted espionage, sabotage, and treason, the United States government demands the full penalty of death.
When these eight guys are apprehended, do they all begin to sing like Dash had done?
They all did. And then they were all taken up to New York. There's newspaper reports that two of the agents promised Dash that he was going to go free. Of course, they had no authority to do so.
You basically spent more time with Dash at the front end of this thing than anybody else. Did Dash ever say to you, how am I going to be treated?
He was concerned, and I explained to him that I didn't know for sure. They might let him free. He might have to be imprisoned. I didn't know.
FDR consulted with his Attorney General, Francis Biddle, and issued an executive order.
That order provided that these saboteurs would be tried not in the civilian courts, not by a regularly constituted court-martial, and not even in accordance with the Articles of War, which governed the procedure for trials of criminal cases in the military, but by a special military tribunal that he convened.
Those eight saboteurs who landed secretly in Florida and on Long Island, put ashore by U-boats. They came to do criminal work against this nation. Two are American citizens, traitors. Now they go to face military justice.
The United States had been at war with Germany since December of 1941. There was great apprehension in the United States, and there was a great deal of concern as to the ability of the United States to combat saboteurs and ultimately to defeat the Axis powers.
FDR decided that there should be a secret trial and an execution. He made that decision almost the first second he heard about the landing of Nazi saboteurs. So it was A, Nazis have landed, B, they're going to die. There was a fantastic degree of national unity. So first and foremost, nobody is going to raise any objections to anything that the president does at this point.
Until this Nazi trial, the last military tribunal held was for the conspirators of President Lincoln's assassination back in 1865.
The conspirators, Louis Paine, George Atzerodt, Mary Surratt, and Dr. Samuel Mudd, were tried by tribunal for their roles in the assassination of President Lincoln. The conspirators were hanged.
The Nazi saboteur trial began July 8, 1942. It took place behind closed doors inside the Department of Justice building in Washington, D.C., a place very familiar to Agent Traynor.
In the same classroom where we were being trained as new agents. They were brought to the Department of Justice every day in armored vehicles with guns.
The tribunal was made up of seven military officers that FDR personally selected.
When Roosevelt set up the tribunal, he set up a blue ribbon group of lawyers, both to prosecute and to defend the case. Biddle was appointed as the lead prosecutor.
Attorney General Biddle has a photograph identified by one of the FBI men who captured the saboteurs.
At the trial, I was, I guess, the first witness called, and the attorney for Dash persisted in asking me, who did I meet, where did I meet him, and is the man here that I met? So I said, yes, he is. He's right over there. He says, no, get up off that chair and come over and stand in front of him, which I did. And Dash said to me, see, I told you we wouldn't meet. Well, here we are.
The lives of the eight Nazi saboteurs hung in the balance.
Who lives? Who dies? That's next on War Stories.
July 27, 1942. After a four-week trial, the defense rested. And on August 4th, the tribunal handed down death sentences for all eight saboteurs, including George Dash, the man who betrayed them to the FBI.
Very soon thereafter, the president commuted the sentences of Dash and Berger to lesser terms. Dash had his sentence commuted to 30 years in prison, and Berger to life in prison.
Attorney General Biddle and J. Edgar Hoover appealed to Franklin D. Roosevelt, saying that these were the people who furnished the information, that cracked the case, and so therefore they had to be given recognition for that in the traditional way, which is to get a lesser sentence than the people who hadn't cooperated.
4 days after the death sentences were ordered, six of the Nazi saboteurs were executed by electric chair at the district jail in Washington, D.C.
Death at dawn. Democratic justice sounding a warning to all who would invade America.
On the day of their execution, Roosevelt was holding a cocktail party for his intimate associates, relatives, and a few friends. And he was absolutely normal, jovial. Roosevelt had an absolute rule that once the cocktail party started, no war business, nothing about politics could be exchanged. It was all gossip. It was all personal chit-chat. And it wasn't until late in the cocktail party that almost in an offhand way, one of his guests said, by the way, what's happened to the Nazi saboteurs? And in so many words, he indicated they've all just been executed.
In the heartland, the search for Nazi saboteurs continued. Young Herbert Haupt's parents, aunt and uncle, and two of his friends were tried for treason.
Unfortunately for them, he told them the truth. That he had been trained as a saboteur. He had landed by U-boat secretly in Florida and now made his way up to Chicago, and he was assigned the job of helping to blow up the American defense industry.
Their claim that they were only helping a relative, not Nazi Germany, fell on deaf ears. All six were found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. Haupt's parents were later deported to Germany.
Interestingly enough, in 1948, both Dash and Berger, who were then serving their sentences, were granted clemency by President Truman and deported to Germany.
You've wrapped up one of the biggest sabotage operations in the United States.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What do you think of your role in this thing?
I was just the right person at the right time. That's all. I was an investigator.
In your generation, there's almost a reluctance to accept the accolades for what you did do. It's a great tribute to your generation. It really is.
Agent Dwayne Traynor stayed with the FBI until 1946. And after he left, he moved back to Illinois to practice law and raise his family.
I don't consider myself a hero. I did a job, and fortunately, it turned out good. You know, that's 3,000 miles ashore from Maine to Florida. And of all the places they had to come in is where I was at that time.
John Cullen was awarded the Legion of Merit for his help in catching the Nazi saboteurs.
I didn't know whether I was going to get out of this situation I was in. Dash was the man in charge. His orders were to kill me. Anybody they met was to be destroyed. But for what reason he did this, I still don't know.
After the trial, he went on war bond and publicity tours for the Coast Guard.
Stay with me, Oliver North, for more war stories on the Fox News Channel. There are thousands of men and women working tirelessly at the FBI, the CIA, the Coast Guard, the INS, and other agencies, protecting America from those who would do us harm. But back in 1942, it came down to one young Coast Guardsman, John Cullen, and a handful of FBI agents to prevent a murderous attack on America's homeland. Theirs is a war story that deserves to be told.